Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione, as always. And I wanted to talk about a topic that's probably near and dear to your heart, John, as a Connecticut native, and that is the objections that the New Civil Liberties Alliance has lodged against a new rule of professional conduct for Connecticut licensed lawyers that the Connecticut Bar has adopted and that appears will be going into effect in January. So what this new provision, and for those who care about the details, this is Rule 8.4 parentheses 7. This is a rule that regulates the speech of attorneys. And there have long been rules of professional conduct around the kind of ways that lawyers can behave. If you are ranting and raving in the courtroom, the judge can hold you in contempt if you're acting in an unprofessional way. But this rule has more to do with the kind of conduct that a lawyer might be engaged in outside of the courtroom. So what the rule says specifically is that it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know, and that's one of the tricky parts here, is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, color, ancestry, sex, pregnancy, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, status as a veteran, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, or marital status in conduct related to the practice of law. And that's the other tricky part, conduct related to the practice of law. This paragraph does not limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from a representation or to provide advice, assistance, or advocacy consistent with these rules. So that's the rule. Now, coming back to the reasonably should know part of the rule, that's pretty vague. So what they're saying is that a lawyer reasonably should know whether something that they're saying, and again, this isn't restricted to things that they're saying in a courtroom. This could be they're participating in a public debate. They're testifying in front of a hearing. They're doing lots of the kinds of things that lawyers do. And they may be opposing something that's popular, or they may be opposing something that's unpopular. I think Connecticut, John, you may remember, I think Connecticut is where there was a lawsuit on behalf of some biologically female women athletes, high school athletes, I believe they were, who were complaining about the fact that athletes who were born male were being allowed to compete in the women's track events and were winning these track events, given the higher testosterone levels. And there was a lawsuit up there over this issue. Well, under this new rule, certain kinds of things that you might say, including perhaps even the way that I just phrased these last couple of sentences, might get you in trouble under this new rule. It might be perceived as something as conduct that the lawyer reasonably should know is discrimination on the basis of gender identity or gender expression, right? That's the concern.
And Mark, that is the concern. And I just want to make sure I'm not a Connecticut lawyer. I resided there in high school, but I don't want anyone to get the impression I'm a Connecticut lawyer. And I will say this, though. What is in Connecticut that raises some worry that there will be overinterpretation of what's offensive in Connecticut? Isn't there a large, famous university somewhere up in New Haven where a lot of these things emerge from?
Are you thinking of Southern Connecticut State University? Oh, no, I bet you're thinking about Yale.
Yeah. I am thinking about Yale, and I'm thinking about the many controversies that have come out of Yale recently, spreading to the law profession. And this is something I used to not think was ever going to happen. I just thought that was all college stuff. And once again, I was being Pollyanna-ish. And
Goldilocks.
But I didn't think it was spread. But now when we see this type of rule come in, and we see this exact type of rule, how it's been interpreted in the academic and other areas, it could really hurt the practice of law, because you have to give your client your unvarnished views much of the time. And, you know,
defend their point of view vigorously, right?
Correct. And that is something that we should think seriously about before this type of rule gets put in. But if it gets put in afterwards, you still have free speech rights, and you still have, you still have to do your job.
Well, and this seems like a pretty blatant violation of the First Amendment. I mean, when I think about sort of offensive speech, one of the first things that I think about, and maybe this is because I'm from Kansas and I am a Kansas lawyer, is the Westboro Baptist Church, which is famous for protesting at funerals and saying all sorts of saying all sorts of nasty things, and to hear these cuss words coming out of the mouths of these oftentimes children who are protesting these things or holding these signs with foul language on them, taking issue with different people's sexuality or at the funerals they're protesting. These are veterans typically that they're protesting. And I would think that all of that conduct would come in violation of this rule for anybody there who is a lawyer. And there are members of the Westboro Baptist Church who are lawyers and who, in fact, argued the Westboro Baptist's case all the way up to the Supreme Court. They didn't entrust that, as I recall, they didn't entrust that argument to some outsider. They took it up to the Supreme Court themselves and won. Like it or not, the Supreme Court upheld the offensive speech as being protected by the First Amendment. And we have a history in this country. A lot of the famous First Amendment cases are offensive cases that you wouldn't necessarily want to be the prototypical examples of the kind of speech that people engage in. But those borderline cases are the ones that make the law and set the boundaries for what the First Amendment protects. And I think that the First Amendment clearly protects some of the kinds of speech by lawyers that this rule prohibits. So that's a problem. And as a result, NCLA has filed a lawsuit on behalf of a couple of Connecticut attorneys seeking a declaration from the U.S. District Court for the District of Connecticut that the rule violates both the First Amendment and provisions of the Connecticut Constitution. We have had these debates before. I mean, the First Amendment fully protects offensive speech, derogatory speech, demeaning speech. There are some things that it doesn't protect, right? It doesn't protect against libelous speech or defamatory speech. But that's not what this rule is going to. And the lack of clarity in this rule really makes it difficult for attorneys to figure out ahead of time what speech and conduct it is proscribing, and how they have to conform their speech ahead of time in order to abide by the rule. So as a result of that, if someone's worried about getting hauled before the disciplinary committee in Connecticut, if an attorney's worried about that, they're going to have to chill their speech on certain subjects in order to provide that margin of assurance that they're not going to be the target of a complaint and an enforcement investigation and all the bad publicity that would come with that kind of event. And a rule like this that grants so much discretion to enforcement personnel to decide what they're going to sanction and what they're not going to sanction is problematic. And the authorities in Connecticut have said, oh, look, we would never go after these kinds of speech that you're talking about here. But that's not the way that these rules are supposed to work, John. I mean,
And Mark,
often the government wants you to trust the prosecutorial discretion, but go ahead.
And the way these things have been interpreted on campuses and elsewhere, there are certain words you can't say, the N word, which I wouldn't say on this podcast or anywhere else, except one place. in the courtroom when you're doing a civil rights case and the claims are that the other side said those things against your client, which has happened in my case, my cases, you have to say the word so you can explain what the offense was. Well, on campuses right now, even if you quote something to show what how bad it was, you can then be sanctioned on those campuses. So here, the defense or the plaintiff's lawyer saying that the employee was subject to this type of abuse and these type of words, by using those words, he could be subject to this very rule if it's interpreted the same way it is in academia.
That's right, and I think that is it's a real concern both about being able to deal with truth, but also there's a real political agenda here. I mean, I don't think anybody is particularly people who have taken the time and invested the effort to become a professional, go to law school. They want to represent clients. They're not doing that so to gain some sort of privilege against other people that would allow them to engage in discrimination or harassment that the law otherwise forbids people from doing. But they are going to be engaged in controversies and so forth. And some of the boundaries that have been set in some of these debates recently, like you have to use certain pronouns to refer to people. And if you don't, then that's considered almost like an assault. Well, that's the kind of behavior. And I think we've seen that in Canada, right? I think maybe even, as you mentioned, at some of the U.S. universities, professors have gotten in trouble for not using certain pronouns. If that kind of conduct is going to get somebody called up for disciplinary sanctions in front of the state bar, then we have a problem in being able to debate these issues in a public setting, or we're trying to essentially take some of the players off of the playing field by saying, look, lawyers aren't going to be allowed to engage in these debates. Well, that's a problem. The rule amounts to a speech code for lawyers. And fortunately, many other states, about 20 or so, have looked at this and rejected this idea. But there are two or three that have gone down this road. Connecticut's the latest. And we certainly hope that the district court strikes down Connecticut's rule as a violation of the First Amendment. We will keep you posted on that here at Administrative Static. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everyone. I couldn't let the week go by without bringing up another court, as I have brought up many of the Supreme Court justices, talking about the press. And this judge is Judge Bruce E. Schroeder. You may know him if you followed any of the Rittenhouse prosecution that's going on right now. And this has been a televised case, and I must say, I have not watched any of it, except I've seen snippets on YouTube or something, and I think this is what the judge is complaining about. There's an article in National Review, and it was in others. I saw it on Yahoo News. It was all over the place. But he has attacked the media as grossly irresponsible of the coverage of the Rittenhouse case. And I will say this, I have followed it, not so much for the case itself, but for the coverage. And one of the things that I like to do is to take a look at things like National Review, and then take a look at things like Slate, and then look at the Wall Street Journal, and then look at the New York Times, and see how they report the same story. And I think when you do these things, you understand that it's almost like the old story of the seven blind men who were trying to describe what an elephant looked at, and you know, one of them was touching the trunk, so he said it was like a snake, and the other one was touching the leg, so he said it was like a tree, and it's like this. Well, depending on what part of the story they want to emphasize, you get a much different view of a court case. Now, there is a long all trials in the United States have historically, just in the Anglo-American tradition, trials are open to the public, and so the public has always been able to go, and that's one of the reasons you have bailiffs and you have the judge with his gavel silencing everybody in all the old cowboy movies and stuff like that. So I'm not going to say that trials haven't always been a spectacle and that some people haven't treated criminal trials like entertainment, but for the participants and Lord knows for the defendant, this is not optimal. And it is a problem, and it always has been a problem. But what Judge Schroeder has TV cameras in his chambers, in his courtroom, and so he says, when I talked about problems with the media when this trial started, we're there in part, not fully, but in part because of grossly irresponsible handling of what comes out of this trial. And he said he'll think long and hard about televising future trials. I've always been a firm believer in it because I believe that people should be able to see what's going on. When I see what's being done, it's really quite frightening, he said. And so what he's asking for is responsible journalism, which given that anyone can write anything, it's pretty hard to get. But it brings up an issue. And I really wonder if the justices of the Supreme Court are looking at this. Because one of the friction points between the Congress, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, but the Congress and the Supreme Court is this issue of whether Supreme Court arguments should be televised. And the justices, I believe most of them are totally against it. And I know it's most of them because they've never had a vote on it that said, let's bring cameras in. The COVID period has come the closest. They have really made sure that their arguments are simulcast. So you can listen to them all as they happen on their website, which is not something that when I was a young lawyer or even an old lawyer, we had. Until recently, it didn't all come with COVID, but it's much, I think it's much more recent. They'd release them later, but now they simulcast them, which, for people who are interested in these things, it's pretty good, but what don't you get? You don't get the look on their face. You don't get it on the 6 o'clock news. They only have audio when someone asks a question, and television hates audio alone. That's why it's television. But in any event, so I wonder if they're not looking at this Rittenhouse trial and looking at this judge who has been around the block. He's been a judge for a very long time. He is very pro camera. And now in the midst of this trial, he's now very worried about it. Well, this is probably the most media intense case he's ever had, even in his long experience. The justices get a Rittenhouse trial basically every October. They get something where the whole world's watching. So they may really take some hard look at this and harden their position. Now, why does that matter? Because at all of the confirmation hearings of the judges, the justices usually get a question by some senator saying, I think the American people deserve to watch your deliberations. And then they typically say, oh, I'll take it under advisement or have no opinion, or we certainly publish all our opinions, which is where the real work is done. It's not done in the oral arguments, but senators don't buy that. And some of the more sophisticated senators, I think they believe that some of the mystery of the Senate has been taken away from them by televising this on C-SPAN. And they wouldn't mind too much the same thing happening to the justices. Now, having been in the Senate chambers and having been in the Supreme Court, I do think over time you'll find that the justices are better behaved and don't do anything wacky. I mean, they don't use charts, but maybe that's because there's no television there. There's a big debate over whether or not the Senate and the House have changed because of television. I think it's indisputable that the House has changed. Because I remember when it happened and the way the House members use television, because they don't get very long to speak, has really changed how they approach their jobs. I think the Senate, since they are the stuffier chamber, and they tend to be a little less. You don't have any Jim Traficants or any of that sort of thing in the Senate that I'm aware of, anyway. And so this issue of cameras in the courtroom, I have to say, I'm usually for transparency of all kinds, but it does strike me that the justices are almost anonymous. Outside D.C., the justices are almost anonymous. No one knows who they are. In fact, I'll tell just a brief story. I was at Mass one night, and this woman came in, and I nodded. I just thought she was another person in the parish that I've seen a million times, and I just didn't know the name of. Because she doesn't go to my church or anything. And so then as I'm leaving church, I'm like, where do I know that? I must have talked to her at some point. Now, it was Amy Comey Barrett. It's just she happened to pop in there, and I just assumed that she was another lady in the church. And I obviously know who she is. I do this podcast, but it didn't strike me immediately who it was. And you think about the rest of the country, they really don't know what the justices look like. Maybe most of you who listen to this radio show, podcast, no. But I think they like their anonymity. I think they like the fact that they can just walk around, and mostly they don't really need to worry too much. Now they have security more than they did when I first got to Washington. But I do think that the cameras would change. It would raise it quite a bit. And it would also give commentators, now this is a free speech issue, would give commentators, they could show someone asking a question, and then one of the justices asking a question, which they often ask questions to see how the law will play out. And then, but someone, a commentator, will unfairly say, aha, that he thinks that, she thinks this, because look at that question they ask. Well, they're often asking questions to weaken a point or to strengthen a point. You don't know always what it is. But TV can make something seem sinister that is not. And certainly TV can, they could modify the feed. They could darken it like they do on the commercials. Whenever politicians are running for something, you notice their opponents are always in black and white in darkness, and then they're in sunny uplands walking with, golden retrievers and things. The guy who's paying for the ad. So you could have that sort of thing as well. I don't think that the justices are going at any point to allow cameras in because of the anonymity and because of, I think, the negative view of what's happened to the House and Senate in their view. But I think this will be constantly friction between them and the legislative and sometimes the president. Often presidents don't care one way or another, but sometimes they do. And they'll talk to the respective justices about it, the ones who are concerned. But the Senate always is asking this question. Their constituents, I think if you asked the American people, do you think their hearing should be televised? I think the answer would be yes. I think it's a majority position in this country. But they are not a majoritarian institution, as we are reminded again and again. And so this television, allowing television for the arguments before them is something where the justices' interests and the justices' outlook is far different from the American public's. And you're seeing this, and I have to thank Judge Schroeder for bringing it up, because what you have here is a guy who is pro-television camera, pro-openness to all of the proceedings, and who is very miffed at what was the result. And there's another thing why trials should be more likely be televised than oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Things actually happen at trials. Decisions get made. For instance, the judge will rule on evidence, right? And people want to see that. People give testimony. That's important. The Supreme Court arguments are interesting, but nothing's decided there. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Thank you for listening. John Vecchione. finding out for administrative static.